What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion for this Monday afternoon. Delighted to have you along. This program is for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Is that you? Are you a non-Catholic? Perhaps anything from Buddhist to Baptist, and you've got a question or two about the Catholic faith? We are here to get those questions answered for you. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response, and once you get it, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. And of course, you can always send us an email. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. Ace McKay pressing buttons randomly and without function. Vanessa Sanchez handling our phone screening today. Rich Jesse is on social media. If you'd like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, just put your question in the comments box. Rich will take it from there. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Hey, Tom. How you doing today?
Well, I'm doing well.
I'm glad to hear it.
You're giving me this Cheshire Cat grin here.
Well, you know, that's the first time I've heard the pushing buttons randomly note on one of our producers, so
well,
Ace can take it, I know.
If anybody can press those buttons randomly, he's the guy.
He's the guy, yeah.
And make it look good at the same time.
Right, yeah. Ace is a man of many talents, indeed.
He is. I'm glad to be back with you. We were at a wedding in Pennsylvania over the weekend. You may remember our former news person here, Deborah Pirock.
Yeah.
She got married.
That is
and,
very exciting.
It was a wonderful thing. And it was funny because I was driving through Lancaster, Pennsylvania to pick up some items for the wedding. I'm sitting there at a stoplight. I look to my right and there's President Buchanan's home, James Buchanan's home. I thought, I don't see that in Alabama.
This oh, no. Oh, no.
Fantastic. All right. We're going to lead off here with an email. This is from Frank. Can you please explain what is meant by a profession of faith? How can someone say they put their faith and trust in Jesus and earn salvation regardless of what they do for the remainder of their lives?
Oh, yeah. Thanks. I really appreciate the question. Well, nobody in the Catholic tradition thinks that.
Nope.
So the position that you just took aim at would not characterize our belief at all. So the way Catholics understand the profession of faith is, so the profession of faith signals what we as Catholics hold in common, right? And so we make a formal profession of faith on entry into the Catholic Church. And even if you're an infant, when you're baptized, the faith is professed vicariously on your behalf, and then you grow up into it. So these are the parameters that mark out, okay, what is Catholic belief versus what's not Catholic belief. But it's the living of the life that unites us to God and assures our place in heaven. Faith does connect us to God and to his gifts of grace. Now we're talking about not the formal profession, but the interior virtue of faith does connect us to God and avails us of his promises and his grace. But we have to cooperate with that grace in order to merit salvation. And so all the scriptures about the end of time and the end of our own lives depict our judgment as a judgment of our works that hopefully will be done in grace, and whereupon Christ will offer one of two verdicts, either well done, good and faithful servant, enter into the joy of your master, or away from me, you evildoers, I never knew you. And that's, when you read Christ's criterion, he never lists profession of faith as one of the criterion for either rejection or acceptance. He doesn't. He doesn't say, well, you know, blessed are you of my Father because you believed the profession of faith. He says, you fed the hungry and clothed the naked, gave drink to the thirsty, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's the connection between the two? Well, through our faith, we are given the strength by the grace of the Holy Spirit and proper instruction to live the ethical life aided by God, right? The faith aids us in that, but it's the living of the ethical life that actually unites us to God.
Frank, thanks so much for your email. We got one from Johan, I believe it's Johan, or could be Johan, in Antwerp, Belgium. He wants to know, is the Catholic Church unnecessarily wealthy? Where does all that wealth go? How was it accumulated? And how do you explain to a non-Catholic why there is so much wealth?
Okay, thanks. So, you know, people have the idea that the Catholic Church is a singular organization in the way in which, say, a publicly traded company is a singular organization where, you know, there's a CEO who runs the whole show down to, I mean, theoretically, the CEO has jurisdiction all the way down, you know, to the janitor that works in a plant on the other side of the planet, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
He has that level of control. And of course, the ownership of the thing is in the common stock that's held by the stockholders, right? And so it's a singular institution that functions as a juridical, an economic person for purposes of law.
Okay.
That's not how the Catholic Church functions. And people think of it that way, but that's the wrong analogy. So the Pope is not the CEO of a corporation of which the parishes are subsidiary members. That's not the relationship. The ownership of property within the Catholic Church is, again, not something that's distributed through common stock, either to the clergy or the laity. And property is distributed across a variety of organizations and institutions and persons across the Catholic world. So, some dioceses are organized in the United States according to the corporate model of corporation sole, where the bishop actually holds the property personally. But they also have different forms of organization where parishes might be independently incorporated. I mean, there's just a lot of ways like the actual ownership of the stuff gets parceled out.
Yeah.
And from diocese to diocese, you might have one diocese that, yeah, controls an awful lot of property and has a good deal of money. You might have another diocese that has practically nothing, right? And I know, particularly in the third world, I mean, I know priests personally whose annual salary in their home diocese that are in the developing world are something like $400 a year.
Wow.
Right? And you know, the retirement plan for priests in such diocese is the priest says, I'd like to live in this parish when I retire. And then the pastor of that parish has the added responsibility of taking care of that retired priest because that's the only way they can do it. Right. And the diocese doesn't have property. I mean, they don't have property.
Yeah, you know,
maybe the bishop owns a house. I mean, that's about it. So we can come back to where the wealth is concentrated and how it got there and whether that's excessive after the break.
I think it's a great idea to continue the discussion because, you know, people see enormous cathedrals. They see, you know, in some cases, office buildings. They go, well, tell me about that. We'll continue that. We'll also talk with Teresa, Michael, Claudia, and hopefully you at 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews on this Monday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We're going to continue that emailed question from Johan in Antwerp, Belgium, who asks these questions. Is the Catholic Church unnecessarily wealthy? Where does all that wealth go? How is it accumulated? And how do you explain to a non-Catholic why there is so much wealth?
Yeah, thanks. So before the break, I started explaining how the Catholic Church is structured corporately in the United States and throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a mistake to think of the church as a singular institution on the model of a common stock company, you know, that's traded on the stock exchange, for example, where it's all held by the common shareholders. That's not the way the Catholic Church is organized. And from diocese to diocese, ownership is held locally in property. And so the Pope does not own, say, you know, if I go to St. Mark's Parish in Birmingham, Alabama, the Pope does not own that piece of property, right? The Vatican does not own that piece of property, right? That's diocesan property. And diocese to diocese, you know, there are huge disparities. So there are dioceses that have almost no money at all, where priests basically don't even draw a salary, and that's, you know, some places in the third world. Well, there are other places where they may have substantial amounts of property.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, is it excessive? How did it get there? Well, one way or the other, the church's property is primarily a result of the donations of the faithful over the centuries, right? And so,
yeah.
You know, one of the first Catholic institutions to really acquire great deal of property were monastic foundations in the Middle Ages because, you know, as institutions, they don't die. I mean, the monks die, but the institution just continues.
Yeah.
And so people would make grants of land, and then, you know, once the monastery's got that, well, it's got it. You know, it hangs on to it, and they'd sometimes hang on to it for centuries, and they would acquire more land. And actually, you know, there's a monastery close to my house in Birmingham, Alabama, and they've got they've got significant tracts of land. And I was talking to the
yes.
to the abbot one time,
uh-huh.
and I know where your mind went, but anyway, you said it,
not me.
And I was talking to the abbot one time, and I said, you know, what are your plans for the future, you know? And there was this parcel of land, you know, that was contiguous or something, and he's
uh-huh.
like, you know, we'd like to add property here or there, and you know, we can afford to wait.
Wow.
Yeah, we can afford to wait, you know.
Talk about the long game.
Yeah, exactly, the long game. You know, you could wait abbots and abbots, you know,
yeah.
for somebody to bequeath property, and then you bequeathed it, and there it is, you know. And so some of the monasteries in Europe that have been around for 1,500 years have had a chance to acquire a great deal of property. And indeed, there were monasteries. I mean, I'm thinking Monte Cassino in Italy, which
yes.
is sort of, you know, the flagship Benedictine institution. In the High Middle Ages was an institution of profound wealth, right? Which is why the parents of Thomas Aquinas, who were aristocrats and wanted only the best for their son, and when they figured out he was going to be absolutely useless as a military commander or, you know, in finance or anything, well, if he's going to go to work for the church, we might as well put him at the head of a wealthy institution. So they tried to, you know, weasel him into to Monte Cassino, but he'd have nothing of it. He went off and joined the hippies of the day, which were the Dominicans, you know. And so that's one way that they acquire wealth. And that's sort of the primary way. Are there singular church institutions that have more wealth than they need, or have perhaps mismanaged it? Of course, absolutely, yeah, right, yeah. That's human beings,
sure,
right?
Sure.
You know, do I feel the need to justify that? No. No, I mean, I'd be perfectly willing to concede that there might be some Catholic parish or diocese or monastery or institution that's mismanaged funds or had more than they need. Sure, right? Okay, so don't give money to those, right? But what about the diocese that has to pay their priest $400 a year and has no retirement plan and they don't have insurance? And, you know, what about those guys?
Yeah.
Well, how about giving money to them, right? Because they're out there serving the poor. I mean, I know a priest from one of these third world countries, and he's over here now. He's in the United States. And, you know, I guess from the point of view of some of his confreres back home, he could be said to be, quote, living the life, end quote, because, like, he's drawing a salary now, like, first time in his life, you know, and he's got a car and he's got a rectory with electricity and food on the table. Oh, wow, you know. But he's just a stand-up individual. And I asked him, I said, you know, how do you feel about your life here? And he said, well, you know, my bishop sent me here and I'm obedient to my bishop, but let me tell you something. What I really liked was when I was at such and such a parish and such a place. I said, tell me about that. He said, they had nothing. They had nothing. Like,
wow.
They didn't have water. When I was there, we dug a well.
Wow.
We got water. It was a big day. One or two people had cell phones. We had to hike, you know, 2 miles up a mountain to get a signal. But they loved. And that's where I want to be. If I get sent back home, if I give a request, that's where I'm going to go, you know.
Beautiful.
So, you know, Catholics are human beings.
Yeah.
Where you function like human beings.
Sometimes people will talk about, you know, well, what about the Vatican museums with all this great artwork? Well, yeah, but that's open to the public.
Yeah,
it's,
sure. So
it's not in somebody's estate.
That's right.
In the middle of Brazil. It's open for everybody,
you know,
to see.
There's a parish in my home diocese, and I'm not going to name names, but it owns a piece of property that probably when they acquired it, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, was not any big thing, you know, but obviously property appreciates. And now it's in a part of town that, you know, if they were to sell that off and turn it into something else, it would be, you know, probably a significant chunk of change if they were to sell it. But what have they done with it? Well, it's just an ugliest sin church. You know, it is not the Vatican archive, I mean the Vatican Museum, by any stretch of the imagination. It's just hideous to behold. But you know what it does? It sits there in the heart of this suburban neighborhood and serves the spiritual needs of countless generations.
Yes, it does.
Right. And that's what it's there for. It's there to serve the spiritual needs of the families.
Johann, thank you so much for listening to us in Belgium. All right, we're going to get to the phones in just a couple seconds here. That number, 833-288-EWTN. We do have lines for you available, 833-288-EWTN. 888-288-3986. Have you checked out the EWTN Pro-Life Pulse? You may not have heard about this. It's your weekly recap of the top pro-life headlines moving our nation and world that, you know, the mainstream media somehow misses that. I just can't imagine why. Do check it out. Visit EWTNnews.com/pro-life. Sign up today for Pro-Life Pulse and stay connected. All right, if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Teresa in Columbus, Ohio, listening on the EWTN app. Hey there, Teresa, what's on your mind today?
Oh, yes, hello. Thank you, Dr. Anders. I would like to have a simple explanation. I've been trying to look up, it came up this weekend, I've been trying to look up the faith alone versus faith and works that Catholics believe.
Yeah.
And I'm, yeah.
Oh, I can help you. Very simple. Yeah. So
the
sort of standard classic Protestant view is that God grants the gift of faith, and through faith, he credits Christ's righteousness to the believer. So in other words, he regards the believer as if the believer had done the good deeds that Christ had done.
Okay.
Right. That's the fancy word for that is imputed righteousness.
Okay.
And in consequence, like, it doesn't matter how bad you are, if God looks at you and only sees the righteousness of Jesus, well, then you're scot-free. You're scot-free. I mean, that's why saved by faith alone, alone, alone. Because through faith, God is able to regard you as righteous, though you remain intrinsically sinful.
Mm-hmm.
God doesn't notice your sins. He sees only the righteousness of Christ. So the metaphor that Martin Luther used to describe that reality was a dung heap covered in snow. Inside, you're all wretched and vile, but on the outside, you're all pure and clean because God sees you as pure and clean. Another way Luther described it, he wrote a famous sermon, gave a famous sermon in 1519 called Two Kinds of Righteousness. And he said, you know, there's the kind of the outward righteousness of the body, the, you know, sort of living in society and following the laws and so forth.
Uh-huh.
But God doesn't care about that, says Luther, right? But the other kind of righteousness is this imputed righteousness of Jesus, this alien righteousness that doesn't belong to me intrinsically, but is granted to me, ceded to me for Christ's sake through faith alone. So that's the idea in the Protestant tradition. And there are variations on that theme, but that's basically the idea. The Catholic view, which I think is the biblical view and is definitely the traditional view, is that we need faith, and faith is a vehicle. It is a medium that brings graces into our life. But the effect of grace is not to impute Christ's righteousness. It's to infuse Christ's righteousness. That is to say that we begin to actually exhibit in our intrinsic character, we begin to exhibit the character of Christ. We are slowly transformed into his likeness and image. And so God's verdict that you are righteous is not the result of a legal fiction, but a genuine transformation.
Mm.
You move from the state of sin to the state of righteousness. God makes you a better person fundamentally. And, you know, when I was growing up as a Protestant kid, like the ultimate heresy, the worst thing you could possibly say, I'm not kidding you, this is true. Like, if you wanted to shoot somebody down and get, well, they really don't get the Christian faith, man. They have missed it by a mile. It was the idea that, well, you know, so-and-so must be going to heaven because he's a good person. And as a Protestant kid, like, if somebody said, well, they're going to heaven because they're a good person, oh, no one's a good person. They've missed it by a mile. It's got nothing to do with being a good person. And when I became a Catholic, I was like, well, yeah, that's actually the whole show, right? It's about being a good person.
Of course.
Now, the trick is, it is very hard to be a good person. In fact, impossible without grace. But with grace, God makes us into actually good people.
There you go. Teresa, thanks so much for your call. And that opens up a line for you at 833-288-EWTN. We have two lines open, 833-288-3986. Call to communion on this Monday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. Let's go now to Michael. He is in Spokane, Washington, listening on the great Sacred Heart Radio. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Oh, thank you both for taking my call here in Spokane. it's going to be 90 degrees the rest of the week here in Spokane.
Wow.
Yeah, it's going to be hot. My question is on baptism. I'm Catholic. But if I could just make a brief trivia item here first. Bing Crosby, famous for White Christmas, Bells of St. Mary's Going My Way, was raised here in Spokane. He was born in Tacoma. And his brother also had the band, Bob Crosby and the Bobcats. And Bing Crosby attended Gonzaga Prep, Gonzaga University. My question is, can a lay person perform baptism?
Yeah, a lay person, yes, absolutely. Lay person can certainly perform a valid baptism. Now, can and should are not the same thing. And there are occasions when a lay person should perform a baptism, and there are occasions when a lay person should not perform a baptism. When should a layperson perform a baptism? A layperson should baptize when the person to be baptized is in danger of death, and there's no clergy person, well, no clergyman around, right? And I attended a baptism one time when the priest showed up on time, and the person being baptized did not. Was very, 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 very late, you know. And in fact, the priest had to split because he had other appointments.
Uh-huh.
And then they had to kick around and find another priest that could do the ceremony. All right. Now, what if in that circumstance, the priest is hanging around waiting for the person to be baptized to show up. Person doesn't show up. Priest has to leave. Person to be baptized shows up, and all the friends and family are sitting around going, "Well, we lost the priest. We don't want to bother anybody else. Uncle John, here, you do it." That would be inappropriate. That's not a case of urgency. A case of urgency.
All right.
Let's say, to take an extreme example, let's say you're languishing in a prison cell in Siberia.
Okay.
And you've shared the gospel with your atheistic cellmate, and he comes to faith and says, I'd like to be baptized, and they're coming to execute me in the morning. You say, "Well, you know, I see this hole in the ceiling here has some water dripping through. Let's take this and I'll baptize you." You know, that would be appropriate. That's the kind of circumstance when a layperson would baptize.
Michael, thanks so much for your call from Spokane. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Joe now. He's in Pittsburgh listening on the EWTN app. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today, sir?
I have a question. If a wedding mass is held on Saturday after 4 p.m., does that meet the Sunday obligation for going to Mass?
I would generally think, yeah. I mean, if they're saying the Sunday liturgy, the vigil Mass liturgy,
uh-huh.
and it's intended as the Mass of the vigil of Sunday, then yeah.
But if they're not, if they're doing other readings, then it wouldn't be, right?
You know, that would be ask a canon lawyer.
Getting a bit in the weeds there.
A bit in the weeds there, yeah.
All right, very good. Joe, thanks so much for your call. Here is Irma now, a first-time caller from California, listening on YouTube. Irma, we've got just a short bit here. What's on your mind today?
Yes, good morning. I love the show. I'm always listening to you guys on YouTube. I'm Catholic, but I have a question. A good friend of mine is Pentecostal, and I wanted to know kind of the two different, like, what's the difference between the two? I don't want to, disrespect her, but I want to learn what's the difference between the difference between.
Yeah, sure. So I'm going to generalize, which always gets me into trouble.
Yep.
Because someone will not be accurately described by my generalization. So please excuse me, those of you. Who I seem to misrepresent. Many Pentecostals, many, not all, but many, in fact, I'd say, I go so far as to say most, believe that one of the fruits of faith is temporal prosperity and physical health, what sometimes we'll call the message of health and wealth.
Mm-hmm,
and that, like most Protestants, they believe a person is saved by faith alone, but they also think that that salvation can include temporal benefits in this life. That's very different from the Catholic Church. We can come back on that more after the break.
Yeah, sit tight there, Irma. We'll continue this call. We'll also talk with Michael calling in from Ohio. Still a couple lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders here on Call to Communion. Glad you're with us for Call to Communion on this Monday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Before the break, we were talking with Irma, a first-time caller from California. She has a friend who is a Pentecostal, and Irma wanted to know, what is the difference between the Pentecostal religion and Catholicism?
Yeah, thanks. So I began before the break by pointing out a major difference that many Pentecostals believe that faith should bring temporal benefits like wealth and physical health.
Uh-huh.
And the Catholic Church has never taught that. In fact, it's taught the opposite, that the disciples of Christ are very often poor and persecuted and live difficult lives, and it's through offering up their sufferings and joining them to those of Christ that they're to be saved, and that the pursuit of temporal blessings, to an excessive degree, is quite contrary to the goals of the spiritual life. So that's a major difference, right? Another major difference is that Pentecostalism considers the charismatic gifts mentioned in St. Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 12, things like speaking in tongues and miracles and words of knowledge and prophecy, things like that, that those things are not only possible, but they're normative, meaning that they should be part of the regular experience of every Christian. In particular, speaking in tongues is normative, and every Christian, if somebody Christian doesn't speak in tongues, there's something deficient about their spirituality. That's another place where the Catholic Church differs quite significantly, because while the Catholic Church acknowledges that such miraculous things can occur, it does not say that they normatively occur or that they should necessarily be a part of the spirituality of every Catholic, or it certainly doesn't say that there's something lacking in an individual spirituality should they fail to manifest such gifts. So those are two major, major differences between the Pentecostal tradition and the Catholic tradition. Some Pentecostals, and this is a minority of Pentecostals, but some Pentecostals deny the dogma of the Trinity, which, of course, is a major, major difference from the Catholic faith. The style of worship is probably the most obvious difference if one were to walk into a Pentecostal church or a Catholic church that might strike you, because Pentecostals tend to exhibit a very exuberant form of worship. In North America, that would be accompanied by kind of very lively music with, high volume and a kind of frenetic energy that is in some respects reminiscent of the rock concert, but with a good bit more personal decency involved, but still, the same kind of rushed and anxious and adrenaline-fueled hoopla that mm-hmm. you might see at a football game will characterize sure. Pentecostal worship. And while it's not totally unheard of to see Catholics, ruffle their feathers a little bit in worship here and now again, particularly in some cultures more than others, there's a difference of interpretation in the meaning of such experiences, in that, a Catholic is perfectly happy to have elevated emotional experiences because that's part of our humanity and they can be useful to motivate us to do, good deeds and virtuous deeds. The Pentecostal is more likely to interpret that emotional energy as itself the manifestation of God's Holy Spirit. And so a person leaving a Pentecostal worship service who's really, sort of gotten his heart beat up might say, for example, wasn't the Holy Spirit moving today? And the Catholic will not form that judgment, right? He will not equate the Spirit's movement with the degree of emotional excitement I experience, mm-hmm. because it could be that maybe I go to worship and I feel nothing. Maybe I go to worship and I feel revulsion. As sometimes we read St. Therese of Lisieux said that, that she went through a period of her life where Catholic rites were actually quite distasteful to her. And it was with some pain and difficulty that she sort of forced herself into the liturgy. And, a Pentecostal would look at that and think, well, there's something deeply wrong with a person who has that kind of response to public worship. Whereas the Catholic Church looks at Teresa's experiences and sees this kind of bitterness of soul as yet another occasion to identify with the crucified and alienated Christ, that you just cannot read off the face of your emotional state, whether it's positive or negative, a one-to-one correspondence with, holiness or virtue. Holiness is compatible with very elevating emotions, but also sometimes with some very devastated emotions or no emotion at all. It's really yeah. not a matter of one's emotional life, but one's willed commitment to follow Christ in the practice of virtue and charity.
Irma, is that helpful for you?
Very helpful. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call from California. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Still time for a few more phone calls at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Congratulations going out to another great EWTN radio partner, now celebrating 10 years with us. That would be the great KHRA 94.1 FM, serving Anchorage, Alaska. Congratulations to Glenn and Brian and their great team there at Holy Rosary Academy from your friends here at EWTN. Let's go now to Michael, a first-time caller from Ohio, listening online, EWTN.com. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yes, I was wondering if this consecration that Our Lady of Fatima directed, that it be done almost 100 years ago to consecrate Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, has not been done. And the proof of it that it has not been done is the fact that she told the children when she appeared that if the consecration is done, Russia will convert. That has not happened. And she also told the children that if the consecration is done, there will be a period of worldwide peace, and that hasn't happened since that time either.
Okay, yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, a couple things we could say about this. First of all, Pope John Paul II declared that the consecration had been done, right?
Yep,
so someone
yep.
who says anything to the contrary is contradicting the Pope. And, you know, Pope Francis once said that he posed the question, who am I to judge, and in a rhetorical fashion. And the answer to that question is, in fact, the person most qualified to judge of anybody on the planet, right? The Pope has the office of judging.
That's right.
And John Paul and all the subsequent popes have judged that the consecration has, in fact, been done. So that's good enough for me. I'm sticking with the judgment of the Church and the Holy Father. So let's talk about why worldwide peace has not eventuated or Russia not been converted, right? Well, first of all, St. Peter told us in his second epistle that to God, 1,000 days is a day and a day is 1,000. Wait, one day is like 1,000 years and 1,000 years is like a day,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
God's timeline is not ours.
Sure.
So I don't know that one necessarily has to expect that you consecrate Russia to the Immaculate Heart and then, you know, wham, it all comes to fruition before the next election cycle, right? I don't think there's anything in the prophecy about that, right? So maybe this is step one in the unfolding of a plan. Maybe we're still in the early church. Maybe we're still in the early church. And this is step one of a plan that will unfold in the equivalent of God's middle age for the history of the church. Maybe we're 10,000 years in the future in the fulfillment of that prophecy. How do you know? How do I know? I have no idea, right? So you just could not say, it's impossible in principle to say that the thing is unfulfilled. Maybe it's fulfilling as we speak, but, you know, on a timeline that we cannot possibly perceive.
His calendar doesn't look like ours.
Exactly, okay. Here's another thing. Maybe the visionaries got it wrong. There's absolutely nothing about the Church's doctrine on Fatima that suggests that we have to take everything the visionaries say exactly at face value as infallibly true. There's nothing that suggests we should take them that way. In fact, everything would point to the opposite conclusion. The Church has never said that private revelation, the visionaries who get private revelations have the gift of infallibility, and they certainly don't have the gift of inspiration. And so let's grant, for the sake of argument, that there is a legitimate, authentic revelation of Our Lady that took place. Okay. Right? To shepherd children who didn't even know that there was a pope, right? Who needed a lot of instruction to communicate what they had received because they didn't know what they were talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's no reason to assume that they got the whole thing right and conveyed it to us word for word the way they heard it. There's no reason to hold that. In fact, we should be skeptical of that conclusion. All right? So maybe they heard it exactly right and they took down a stenographer's report and God is fulfilling that prophecy on his own timeline. Or maybe there's some aspect of it that we missed because of the fallibility of the messenger, namely shepherd children.
Yeah, there you go. Michael, thanks so much for your call from Ohio. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Excuse me. Got an email from a devoted listener in Clarksburg, West Virginia. Her name is Karen. She says, Dr. Anders, this may seem presumptuous, but I'm asking regardless. If God has no past or future, and he exists in the present, is it possible that through his mercy and through prayers of loved ones, he might save someone who otherwise would go to hell. Grateful for your service, authority, and wisdom, devoted listener Karen.
So the question is ambiguous. Might God save someone who would otherwise go to hell? Well, just taken the way you've stated it, there is no one who is saved on any other terms, right? Every single human being who is saved would otherwise have gone to hell but for the intervening grace of God, right?
Yep.
So I think you must not mean it the way you said it, right, is my inclination. I have heard people, because you raised the specter of God's timelessness, which makes me wonder if you're asking about whether God might save someone who at the moment of their death, say, you know, 100 years ago, would seem to have died in the state of mortal sin. Could God sort of like set the clock back and change the past or something like that? I have known Catholics that have spouted such things in the past and maintained that, you know, God in his timelessness could act sort of retroactively. I don't hold that myself. And the reason I don't is that I see no precedent for that in the church's liturgical tradition, right? The way the church prays for the dead presumes the finality of their final choice, right? When someone's dead, we never say, God, make it the case that they didn't die in mortal sin. What we do is we say, we don't know whether they died in mortal sin or not.
Yeah.
God, have mercy on their soul. You know, grant them the help they need to make it out of purgatory if that's where they landed, so to speak. You know, but we never like, nobody's praying for the salvation of Judas.
No.
You know, and there's just no precedent for that in the tradition. And so this is the sort of thing the church doesn't dogmatize about. But I'd say the whole weight of Catholic tradition and prayer and devotion is against it.
Karen, thanks so much for being a devoted listener there in Clarksburg, West Virginia. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Still time for a few more calls at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. A little bit later on this afternoon, 5 p.m. Eastern, it'll be Ave Maria in the afternoon with our friend Dr. Marcus Peter, examining church, culture, and current events through the lens of faith from the heart of the church. Wonderful program, Ave Maria in the afternoon, 5 p.m. Eastern, right here on EWTN Radio. All right, Mary's watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Mary says, who keeps the Pope in check? What happens if he teaches error? How is he removed? Thanks, Mary, watching on YouTube.
So, let me tell you a funny story. I was very good friends with the man who used to be the editor of the English language version of the Pope's newspaper, Le Servitore Romano. And Lambert Greening was his name.
The Vatican newspaper.
Yeah, the Vatican newspaper.
Yeah.
And he was a wonderful man who was infallibly Orthodox. Well, only the Pope's infallible under certain circumstances. But
yeah.
You know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
he was profoundly committed to the church's orthodoxy.
Sure.
And he suffered no fools, right? He would stand up for the faith regardless of who he was contending with, whether that was a bishop or anybody else. You know, he was going to stand for the church and with the church always, you know. And in his capacity of editor of the Pope's newspaper, he sometimes made enemies, right, with people who wanted him to say or do things that he was not going to violate his conscience to say or do, right? And sometimes these were people who were important, either in the Vatican or, you know, worldwide church hierarchy, and they would push on him, and he would push back, you know, hard. And he told me the story. He said one time there was this fellow, you know, a high-ranked prelate, who said to him, who do you think you are? What do you think your job is? And this is, by the way, this was under the pontificate of Pope John Paul II.
Okay.
And he shot back without hesitating. He said, what's my job? Oh, that's simple, to keep the Pope infallible.
Ooh.
He was kidding, of course, you know. And the guy was incensed. So he says, I'm going to go tell the Pope on you. I mean, this is like grammar school, you know. I'm going to go tell the Pope. He says, you do that. He runs off and tells John Paul II what Lambert had said. And he comes back and Lambert said, what did the Pope say? He said, oh, the Pope laughed. They said, yeah, because Pope's got a sense of humor, you know?
Yes.
But anyway, that's a good story. But that was not his real job, right? Pope's not infallible because Lamborghini kept him infallible, right?
Right.
But no, how do you keep the Pope in check, right? How do you do that? So there's two circumstances here. One is if the Pope intends to define a dogma of the church That is to say, something that all Catholics are obligated in conscience to believe as having been revealed by God. Now, not that the Pope reveals it,
right?
But the Pope declares that this had already been revealed in the deposit of faith, and I'm just certifying that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
When the Pope does that, it's the teaching of the Catholic Church that the Holy Spirit protects him from error. It's what we call the charism of infallibility. So under a very restricted set of circumstances, what keeps the Pope in check is the Holy Spirit. And you ask, well, you know, if the Pope is, let's say, on the verge of defining an error, all right, how would the Holy Spirit keep him in check? Well, maybe he'd kill him.
Could be.
And there are some anecdotes about popes that had picked up the pen to sign documents that were a bit squirrely and died in the process.
Wow.
You know? So maybe God take him out.
Could be.
Maybe God take him out. But in one way or the other, the Holy Spirit protects the church from error in the very rare circumstance that the Pope is going to define a dogma. All right. If he's not defining a dogma, if he's just sort of carrying out his daily task of being Pope and appointing bishops and preaching homilies and, you know, writing apostolic letters and promulgating laws and things of that sort. When he's doing that kind of business, there's no guarantee that he's infallible. And he can make mistakes. He can make prudential errors. He can make factual errors. And he can, although this is uncommon, but it can happen, he can make doctrinal errors. All right? There's a celebrated case in the 14th century when John the 22nd was a pope who in fact taught an erroneous doctrine regarding the beatific vision. He did not teach it infallibly. He didn't proclaim it as a dogma. It was his own private theological belief, but he was in error. And he pushed pretty hard on it, and theologians at the time pushed back pretty hard. I mean, Paris, which was the theological academic capital of the world, the Parisian theologians were against him. A lot of the bishops were against him, and they really pushed back and said, "Pope, you're wrong." And he didn't like that, and he threw a couple people in jail. But he eventually recanted and said, well, that was just my private opinion, and I never defined it. And then the subsequent pope then infallibly taught the Orthodox dogma on the beatific vision to kind of clear things up and make sure nobody, you know, got confused by the previous pope's errors. So in that instance, what would keep the pope in check would be, A, his conscience, and you hope the pope has one. And then the Pope is the most important but not the only organ of the Church's magisterium. So you've got ecumenical councils and bishops and other hierarchs in the Church, and in fact, even lay people. So Catherine of Siena was a Third Order Dominican, which is really kind of a glorified layperson, who had no particular standing in the Church. And the Pope in her day had left Rome and was living in Avignon, France, and playing cards and hunting and, you know, hanging out with his nieces and nephews and really not doing the job of Pope at all. And so it wasn't a doctrinal error, but it was a moral error. And Catherine of Siena shows up in Avignon and says, "Pope, get back to Rome. You don't belong here, you know." And can you imagine the hubris of the thing? But she had a kind of tremendous standing in the public eye because of her holiness, kind of like sort of the Mother Teresa of the day. I mean, Mother Teresa could walk around and speak truth to power because of who she was, you know. Yeah. Catherine of Siena was like that. And strange thing is, he listened to her. He kind of resented her for it for the rest of his short life, but he did. He listened to her, and he got back to Rome, you know. She rebuked him, and he was like, oh, my gosh, she's right, you know. So even lay people, but Code of Canon Law says that the faithful have the right, sometimes the duty, to make their mind known to their ecclesiastical pastors on the needs of the church. Now, you know, you can't, the lay people don't have the power to force a pope to comply, but they can certainly air their grievances, and if Pope has got a conscience, he's going to take good counsel and listen to people.
A couple of great questions there, Mary. Thanks for watching us on YouTube this afternoon. It is Called to Communion on this Monday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. Here's one an email now from John, who says, "Dr. Anders, I love your show. I particularly like your honesty when addressing Psalm 88. You frequently reference Mother Teresa for obvious reasons. Dr. Anders, it's my understanding that most religious orders start the day with daily Mass. I don't think you can answer this definitively, but I hope you can speculate on it. What state of grace is there if someone is receiving daily communion at Mass and yet is not even sure that God exists? Of course, I am referencing Mother Teresa here. I'm wrestling with a 40-year drought myself. Any insights are appreciated. God bless, John."
Yeah, I profoundly appreciate the question. So I'm thinking about how I want to answer this. So I want you to think about two different kinds of people, all right? I want you to think of someone who spends all day listening to EW10 radio. Good choice, by the way. Good choice.
Yes.
You know, all the good shows, you know, reads all the right books from EWTN publishers and from Ignatius Press and you name it, and teaches his kid the catechism and learns apologetics and how to defend the faith, and maybe takes an interest in the pro-life cause and likes his smells and bells at liturgy and, you know, kneels to receive communion and prays the rosary daily with his kids and sort of goes through all the stuff of Catholic life and does it like the way he's going to hear people on this network tell him to do it, right?
Oh, yeah.
And feels pretty darn good about himself in consequence because, you know, hey, he's struck on the truth and he was clever enough to figure that out and he can best you in apologetical debate and he can show you the 15 reasons why Protestantism is wrong and why Catholicism is right and he can defend prayers to Our Lady, which he's keen to do and keeps a schedule every day and feels pretty good about himself for it. And, you know, and maybe his kids are a little bit resentful that he's forced this thing down their throat, but after all, he knows what's best and what do they know? And he doesn't have to listen to them. And, you know, and so he, you know, he's taken up with his own prayers and devotions and making sure his kids learn what they're supposed to learn. But, you know, who cares if you listen to their heart and care about their feelings and then lo and behold, you know, the kids grow up and they're alienated from the church and from their father. And he's kind of wondering why life has fallen apart on him because he didn't do all the right things. Right. But of course, we know from St. Paul and from all the doctors of the church that saying and doing and all the right things and even being intellectually persuaded of their truth is not the thing that saves us. Francis de Sales wrote in his Introduction to the Devout Life that true devotion is not learning the catechism or praying the rosary or going to mass or even giving alms or even fasting or even catechizing your kids or joining the pro-life cause or whatever the good things these things are, they are not true devotion, which is nothing other than the love of God and neighbor, right? And St. Augustine taught the same thing. He said, you know, all the stuff of Catholic life is just a means to an end. The end is, in fact, transformation and charity. Now take somebody who did all that stuff and then reality smacks them in the face and they are struck with enormous amount of tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And the God who they were so sure of lets them down like the psalmist in Psalm 88 is let down. And they reach out for God in prayer and they get nothing but darkness and silence back. Well, all of a sudden now they're in company with John of the Cross. And they go to liturgy and the people around them who seem to have had a sort of a shallow appreciation for the depth of their suffering and are so laxed, so self-assured in their piety begins to fill this black soul with despair. Well, now they're kind of sound like God, who said in Isaiah, I hate your liturgical feasts. God said that about the liturgy. He said, I hate your liturgies, he says to Isaiah, because they're done with such the wrong spirit. Now they're sounding like Thérèse of Lisieux, who went through her own period of, like, couldn't stand the liturgy, couldn't stand the prayers of the church. Mm-hmm. They filled her soul with revulsion at a period in her life, right? Who doesn't even know who this God of love is anymore. Because after all, love doesn't feel like this. You know, Teresa of Avila said, God, if this is how you treat your friends, it's no wonder you have so few of them, right? Who is this God of love, after all, that I'm supposed to be professing and believing, that I can define, but I sure as heck don't feel like I can experience? Well, now they're right in there with Psalm 88.
Yeah.
Right? And so they don't feel God. They don't see God. They don't understand God. They don't like the liturgy. They're alienated from their fellow Catholics. They can't make sense of it all. All right? And in that depth of their own crushing disillusionment and sorrow, you know, that child who previously it was so important to teach the catechism to, like, turns and looks and says, Father, I'm hurting. And that man who once had all the answers and now has none turns to that child in compassion, looks them in the eye and says, I don't know, but one thing I do know, and that is I will never leave you or forsake you.
Mm.
And I'm there with you no matter what. All right? And they mean it, and they would die, and they would give their blood, because the only thing they know left in the world is the one thing I will never give up. is love for the dependent people that God has put in my life who I'm here to serve. And that is what I'm going to do, whether I know anything else at all or not. And they've come to this through the crushing disillusionment of faithfully living their Catholic life. Which one do you think is closer to God in that moment? What does the church say? Well, it's the latter rather than the former. Go read John of the Cross. Go read the Ascent of Mount Carmel. Go see if what he's talking about when he says, at the height of the mountain, when you've gotten to the top of Mount Carmel, what do you find? This is what the doctor of the church says. You find nothing. And therein lies your salvation. Now chew on that. That's the heart of Catholic mysticism.
John, fantastic email, and what a great way to end this program. Dr. David Anders, thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Tom.
We do it right here on EWTN Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern. If we didn't answer your question today, do give us a call tomorrow. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow on Call to Communion. God bless.